My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. So, this is episode number 4 on Blonde on Blonde. These are going so quickly now. I hope you've been enjoying them. Thank you for all your messages on the episode so far. Before we start this one, by the way, a couple of big songs to look at in this episode. Before we get to that, let's give some more Patreon shout-outs. These are people that have signed up to support the show and get some bonus episodes as well. The Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra Show is on Patreon. Oh, by the way, I had a couple of messages from people saying, can you get the extra show on your normal podcasting app? Yeah, you can import the show. It's really easy to do. There's a how-to guide and everything, so don't worry about that. It's really technically easy. But basically, I do a show like these ones every other week, and that runs throughout the year, but we're not just concentrating on Dylan's albums. So there's analytical episodes on Ballad of a Thin Man and songs like that, songs like Up to Me Too. What a great song that is. More recently, Mummy, You've Been on My Mind. There was an episode on that. Also, there's an interview with Scarlett Rivera, the violin player from the Desire album, too. She gives a great insight to Dylan and those sessions, and that kind of time as well. And there's bonus episodes popping up over there. So you get an episode every other week, and then there's a bonus episode that pops up every now and then. So like, for example, I recently did an interview with a guy called Will Taylor, who is the lead singer for a band you might be aware of called Flight. And I asked him to put together his perfect Dylan album, and that was really enjoyable. That's going up in the next 24 hours. So you get an episode every other week, and then you get bonus episodes popping up in between those as well. You can sign up in the link, which is in this episode's description. It's a fiver a month. Let's say hello to some people that have done that. Hi to Arthur Fields, hi to Craig Danieloff, hi to Bjorn, Bjorn Steen, hi to Timothy Feather, hi to Ole, hi to Timothy Goodman, hello to Alan Thomas, hi Craig Mason, hi to Ryan Bogash, and hi to Mark Tuffin as well. The link to Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra is in this episode's description. So let's have a look at the next two songs on this incredible record. Two big songs for me. One of them is not necessarily a classic, but I think a fun song nonetheless. And one is definitely a stone cold 10 out of 10 classic. We look at those, and we also look at the album's artwork. So let's go back once again to 1966's Blonde on Blonde.
You say you love me and you're thinking of me, but you know you could be wrong. Say you told me that you wanna hold me, but you know you're not that strong.
On March the 13th, 1966, Dylan is back in New York. He'd just played a show in Colorado where he'd added Just Like a Woman and other new songs into his set. He'd also recorded some songs in a hotel room in what we can loosely call the last recording session of the Blonde on Blonde era. You can hear songs like If You Want My Love and Don't Tell Him, Tell Me on the collector's edition of the Cutting Edge box set, if you have a spare £1,500 and an eBay account, that is. Bob was back in New York with Robbie Robertson. They stopped by photographer Jerry Schatzberg's studio to find some potential images for the cover of the newly cut Blonde on Blonde LP. Robertson recalls Schatzberg projecting some images onto a wall for them to consider. He was giving a running commentary to each photo, he writes in his autobiography. Oh, there's a nice one, or that one's too dark. That one's got a nice composition, but it's a little bit out of focus. He recalls this happening and then Dylan stopping him after he said that. Dylan said, I like that blurry shot. Straight away you could tell it was going to be the one. The shot had been taken on February the 8th in the meatpacking district before Dylan had even gone to Nashville. It was blurred because, well, it was freezing cold. Jerry says, returning to the area in 2015, I know everyone thought it was a drug shot, but it was February and I was just wearing this little jacket and Dylan was wearing something similar. It was cold. We were both shaking. As I'm sure you know, there's nothing quite like the biting New York cold. I mean, for a start, I've lived in the UK and I've been to many cold places like Iceland, for example. Nothing can quite compare to that New York cold. In classic 60s style and in classic Dylan style, Schatzberg can't remember the actual location of the shot. In trying to find the actual building and the location in a YouTube video, he says, I think it's here. Well, it could be. I thought the building might have been demolished, but maybe not. I mean, it's probably totally disguised now. He says of the actual shots, I was quite pleased. It kind of stands out much more. If it was Columbia choosing the artwork, I'm sure they'd have never chosen something like that, something out of focus. After Dylan chose that very shot, he brought it and other photos of Jerry's to a meeting at Columbia Records with art director John Berg. He was there to finalise the photos and the rest of the artwork for the album. As Dylan was walking down the hall, he was approached by a young photographer named Charlie Steiner. Charlie was a student at the University of Pennsylvania and had taken some live shots of Dylan when he performed at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia back in February. Charlie remembers, "I was in touch with the art department at Columbia Records and I told them I had some pictures of Dylan. I brought them over and I met a young art director and I just left the photos with her. She called me back a few days later and said, 'We really like these pictures, but we just don't have any use for them. So can you come and pick them up?'" As fate tends to do, Steiner was in luck. The day he went to pick up the photos was the day that Dylan was in to discuss the Blonde on Blonde artwork. He remembers seeing Dylan in the hallway. He says, "I went out in the hallway and I gathered my composure. Then I found him and I said that I'd taken some pictures of him and I showed them to him. I think he liked them." Steiner thinks the appeal of the photos to Dylan was that he showed Dylan with an instrument. He said none of the other pictures he had with him showed Dylan with a guitar. Steiner goes on to remember they were interrupted in the hallway by some passing people. He says, "At one point, there was a guy that came up to him and he brought some Columbia executives and they came to shake hands and he got introduced to people. It was interesting seeing him in that situation. He was being really polite and almost businesslike. The only thing he could say was, 'I've got a new single coming out and it's called I Want You.' I think he repeated that two or three times. It's good to see that even Dylan can be a little socially awkward." After this exchange, Dylan went back to the photos. Steiner says he was going through my box, and when we got to a picture, he said, "That's weird, man. For me, that was an honour, having one of my photos called Weird by Dylan. But he liked it. He liked it so much, he would end up using it on the inside cover of Blonde on Blonde, along with 8 photos from Schatzberg." The now famous choice to use the blurred image not only as the album's artwork, but to spread it across the entire gatefold, was from Columbia Records art director John Berg. Because it was a double album, it was necessary to use a gatefold cover. Berg decided the blurred shot should be spread across the front and back. He says that was a, quote, big selling point. In a 2012 interview with East Hampton Star, he says everyone then wanted one because they'd never seen that before. He also chose not to include any name of the album or the artist on the front, confining it only to the spine. He says that was another big deal. The artwork for this record is not only excellent, but like all great albums, it's curious and it has a story or two. Inside and slightly to the left of that inside cover, there is a shot of a man who has his back to the camera. Over the years, there's been speculation as to the man's identity. Schatzberg confirms this man is Dylan's former manager, Albert Grossman, and the photo was taken at the first shoot at his studio with Dylan the previous autumn. There's another shot on the inner cover that has encouraged discussion down the years. It's of Dylan and an unknown woman. It has a weird backstory. Schatzberg remembers saying, "I once had a woman from the UK who wanted to interview Bob. She came to me on some sort of strange premise that she was the editor of Queen magazine. She wanted me to photograph her, and I did it. And while I was taking pictures and while I talked to her, she told me that she'd just done an interview with Marlon Brando, and she told me that she was a lady. She was a big deal. Then she said, 'You know Bob Dylan, right? Can I interview him?' And I said, 'Oh, I don't know, maybe.' Later, I told Bob the whole story and how bizarre it was, and I said, 'If you want to do the interview, we can do it.' He said, 'Okay, but you've got to come along.' So we went to the Dakota building to do the interview, and it was strange. Her first question was, 'Well, now you're famous, how much money do you make?' And he said, 'I make all of it.' And the whole interview was like that. She asked him, 'Do you believe in nature?' And Bob would say stuff like, 'No, I don't believe in any drugs.' I would love to find that interview somewhere. Maybe it still exists. Maybe it was never even published. It turns out she was a real con artist. I found out later she stole and conned loads of money. She was a real number. Despite that, she still makes it into the Blonde on Blonde artwork. And strangely, that bizarre side story is the kind of perfect narrative for this album. Even possibly the album's 8th track, which is a classic. Nobody feels any pain tonight as I stand inside the rain. Dylan began writing Just Like a Woman in Kansas City on Thanksgiving. It's the best example of Dylan doing Sinatra before Dylan actually did Sinatra. It's a torch song, another late night tale. Buttery's Dainty Feels set the tone. They're so important to this song. We've heard Dylan had abandoned an early version without them. He said, "I think the drums should be there. I can't sense this without the drums." And he's right. They offer so much to this particular track. Dylan's aching harmonica adds to this tone with its raspy beauty, and Robin's piano is beautiful too. It twinkles when it has to, and it becomes bar piano-esque on the chorus. But also simultaneously, it reminds me of the piano on Bridge Over Troubled Water. It has a big boldness about it. The picked acoustic guitar is the triumph of the song, though. Its beautiful riff cascades during every single second of the track. It's like a spinning wheel. It never stops. It just keeps going round and round and round, continuously dancing. It also delivers a proper riff, something which is actually fairly common on Blonde compared to a lot of other Dylan albums. It happens as we move from the chorus either back to the verse or to an instrumental section. It combines with Cooper's organ, which, again, Cooper picks a lovely tone for, while everything else drops out. For me, it's such a crucial part of the song. It aids that feeling of reflection on the track. It creates that moment of space. For these bars, it's like everything else goes into slow motion as our narrator gathers himself. It also acts as the perfect setup to the song's harmonica break. It all goes quieter briefly, and then we return with that big harp sound. No wonder this is in Dylan's 20 most played songs live. It is the epitome of a classic.
But you break just like a little girl.
Just Like a Woman is one of those songs that can have many interpretations. But for me, it's not your straightforward love song. It feels like it exists in the same realm as Like a Rolling Stone, with a similar, slightly annoyed disposition, a sort of put-down song, but not as vicious as a song like Positively 4th Street. All these songs feel like they're in the same league in terms of content. It doesn't surprise me that Like a Rolling Stone and Just Like a Woman are written within the same year. Like we've seen many times before, similar themes keep re-emerging in this era of Dylan's work, especially in these particular songs. On this tune he sings, "It was raining from the first, and I was dying of thirst, so I came in here, I can't stay in here, ain't it clear?" Which feels very similar to that stuffy room on Pledging My Time, as Bob sings, "Well, the room is so stuffy, I can hardly breathe." There's also similarities to the aforementioned Like a Rolling Stone. Here Dylan sings, "Everybody knows that baby's got new clothes, but lately I see her ribbons and her bows have fallen from her curls." Which sounds like a Rolling Stones verse of, "People say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. And once upon a time, you dressed so fine." In both these songs, we hear about an it girl who has fallen on hard times. She's putting up a front in those new clothes, but it's not really working, it's all going wrong. This is continued onto the chorus with the now famous lines of, "She takes just like a woman, she makes love just like a woman, she aches just like a woman, but she breaks just like a little girl." This is a lyrical device that Bob has used a lot before. It's a staple of blues music. He repeats the setup and then delivers the punchline. Just like on Most of the Time, for example, when he sings, "I can handle whatever I stumble upon, I don't even notice when she's gone." Most of the time. There's a setup and then a payoff. Here he tells us how strong the woman is. She is sexually liberated and sophisticated, but she can easily break too. Some have called this song and those particular lines misogynistic, and while you can choose to read it either way, a sexist put-down, what's wrong with being a girl anyway, or a device that just makes use of similar nouns, woman and girl, to illustrate a different point. But for me as a man, it's not really my place to defend or declare how anyone should feel about it. But what we do get on the chorus is a clear sign that our woman has a fatal flaw, a vulnerable disposition. But what exactly is that fatal flaw? One idea is that it's drugs. Dylan tells us she's an amphetamine user for a start. He sings, "With her fog, her amphetamine and her pearls" on the second verse. He also tells us in the opening line that nobody feels any pain. This again could suggest it's putting us in a drugs setting. Like everyone is strung out, there's no bad vibes. When recording the song on the 8th of March, they started the session with it. But it was proving difficult. As we heard on a previous episode of this podcast, they went on and got Pledging My Time, returning to Just Like a Woman after that. Before they did, Dylan, of course, tinkered with the lyrics. They were different to this final version in the early stages. For example, in the second verse, it was Annie, not yet Queen Jane, who was the woman's friend. And he had yet to add fog and amphetamine to that pearls line. Instead, he sang, "But I gave you those pearls." Not only are drugs explicitly mentioned in that tinkering, but also Annie is drug slang for, you guessed it, amphetamines. One of Dylan's choice drugs in this era. He, of course, changes it to Queen Mary, which could be an allusion to Mary Jane, the famous nickname for marijuana. Perhaps Dylan is mentioning his indulgences along with his subject as he sings, "Queen Mary, she's my friend. Yes, I believe I'll go see her again," as in he'll continue to use marijuana. Later, he sings, "It was raining from the thirst and I was dying of thirst, so I came in here. And your long-time curse hurts, but what's worse is the pain in here. I can't stay in here, ain't it clear?" Perhaps her long-time curse is her long-standing addiction, something that our narrator is trying to get away from. He then takes this feeling of trying to get away or out of something and makes a statement of intent. He sings, "I just can't fit. Yes, I believe it's time for us to quit." If this is a drug song, then maybe our narrator is looking to get away from them, but this woman is falling deeper and deeper into that murky world, cracking up and breaking. This all leads to the song's best line. In the final verse, Dylan sings, "But when we meet again, introduced as friends, please don't let on that you knew me when I was hungry and it was your world." This might be Dylan asking our woman to conceal his past addictions, to forget the man he once was, to not let the world know what he was like before he built this new image. While, of course, drugs might be nowhere near the heart of this song or anything to do with it at all, Dylan might have just added that amphetamines line to, I don't know, cool it up a little. Regardless, it, as we've seen elsewhere, is something bad that our narrator's trying to get out of. On an early version of the song, the lyrics read, "Don't let me down like you did before. I must go out into the world." He's trying to break away and get free from this relationship, from this problem, from this bad behaviour and get into the world and stand on his own two feet away from these bad habits. The song, of course, could just as easily be about fame. Perhaps that's causing this character to break. Which leads me to another of the main theories behind this particular track. The idea is the song is about Joan Baez. Baez championed a young Dylan. Those three lines at the end of the verse could easily read like Dylan is voicing the difficult turn that his fame brought to their relationship. He's no longer that shaggy folk vagabond. He's now a star, and a bigger star than Joan. It could also easily be about socialite Edie Sedgwick. As we've seen before in this podcast, her story of Rich Girl Lost fits a lot of Dylan tunes from around this time, from Like a Rolling Stone to here. Especially when thinking of that fog, amphetamine and pearls line. Edie's problems with drugs has been well documented. So, whether drugs or not, Just Like a Woman is a sad love song about a woman who can't handle a setback. Dylan is half putting her down, half feeling sorry about it all. While there is a hint of Sedgwick in this song, there's even more speculation the album's preceding track is about her. Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat has been called a satire of the fashion industry, which I don't particularly see. I don't think that Dylan would be against the world of fashion. I mean, he might not be particularly for it, but is he annoyed enough by it to pen an entire scathing put-down of it? Not for me. This, again, I think, is a love song. Nico, the German singer, Warhol tribesperson and Velvet Underground collaborator, agrees. She's quoted as saying, "Bob's song Leopardskin Pillbox Hat is written about Edie Sedgwick. Everybody thought it was about Edie because she wore leopards." Nico went on to call it a very nasty song. For Bob's standards, though, I don't think it's that nasty. The worst it gets, really, is Bob says he doesn't like her hat that much. Hardly a scathing put-down. He sings, "You know it balances on your head just like a mattress balances on a bottle of wine. Your brand new leopard skin pillbox hat." This is a goofy, funny song. It, along with Rainy Day Women, has a touch of the novelty song about it. However, with Dylan, as always, there's some really nice wry lines in and amongst this. He sings, "Well, I asked the doctor if I could see you. It's bad for my health, he said. Yes, I disobeyed his orders, and I came to see you, but found him there instead. You know I don't mind him cheating on me, but I sure wish he'd take that off his head, your brand new leopard skin pillbox hat." Everyone in this song is seemingly obsessed with this hat. So much so, in the final verse, our narrator sings, "Well, I see you've got your new boyfriend. You know I've never seen him before. Well, I see you making love to him. You forgot to close the garage door. You might think he loves you for your money, but I know what he really loves you for. It's your brand new leopard skin pillbox hat." When Rolling Stone editor Jan Winner asked what the song was about, Dylan told him, "I think that's something I might have taken out of a newspaper, or I might have seen a picture of one in a department store window. There's really no more to it than that." He also might have got it from the Lightning Hopkins song Automobile Blues, where the pillbox hat is essentially replaced by a car. Hopkins sings, "I saw you riding round in your brand new automobile. Yes, I saw you riding round, babe, in your brand new automobile. Yes, you were sitting there happy with your handsome driver at the wheel in your brand new automobile.
I saw you riding round. You were riding in your brand new automobile. Yes, I saw you riding round. You were riding round in a brand new automobile. Yes, you were sitting there happy with your handsome driver at the wheel in your brand new automobile."
Bob doesn't stop at pilfering the general vibe either. In the second verse of the Hopkins song, he sings, "The woman's car is pretty and wondered if he might drive it sometime." In his song, Dylan calls the hat the woman is wearing pretty and then asks if he can jump on it sometime, in a deliberate Dylan curveball to throw in the ridiculous and manipulate that old blues song. In an early take of the tune, Dylan had more verses that were ultimately cut. In an early New York session, he sings, "Well, I don't drink whiskey, no, I don't drink gin. But I'm so dirty, honey, I've been working all day in the coal bin." He would also nod to another song in that version, this time "Me and My Chauffeur Blues" by Memphis Minnie. In the song, Minnie sings, "Won't you be my chauffeur? Won't you be my chauffeur? I wants him to drive me. I wants him to drive me downtown." Here, Dylan sings, "Well, can I be your chauffeur, honey? Can I be your chauffeur? Well, you can ride with me just as long as you stay in the car. If you get outside to walk, you might just topple over in your brand new leopard skin pillbox hat." This song has been analysed a fair amount, but for me, it's just a fun little mess around and we shouldn't get too obsessed with what it actually means. It incorporates some other songs and it's a playful tune about an ex that our narrator doesn't really care about too much when all's said and done. So perhaps Nico is right. Maybe this is about Sedgwick. She doesn't necessarily seem to be a big love of Dylan's life. He's never really been too forthcoming about her in the way he's mentioned other lovers like Suze or Joan or Sarah, but unlike Nico, I don't think this is a serious song. His time with Edie, if indeed there was much time at all, seems to be much more in the minor leagues compared to some other lovers. So if there was going to be a song about her, I think it would be a throwaway song like this one. And while yes, it is a little throwaway and possibly in breach of some copyrights, the Dylan cut for me, musically, really sizzles. The guitars in it are some of my favourite bits on the record. They have that thin Mercury sound, that scratchy blues. It actually is a great example of the album's overall sound.
Well, you look so pretty in it. Honey, can I jump on it sometime? Yes, I just want to see if it's really the expensive kind.
The song has all the energy of a one-take wonder, which, as we heard on the second episode of this podcast, is exactly what it is. However, interestingly, it seems to have been a favourite of Dylan's. Unlike a lot of other songs that made it onto the album, it was attempted in both New York and then revived in Nashville. In the Big Apple, they attempted it on the 25th of January 1966. It was the session after the infamous She's Your Lover Now session, where Dylan was starting to come to the conclusion that the band weren't working out. Here, though, he was back. And while they did get One of Us Must Know completed, at the start of the session, they tried Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat with less success. Dylan was on the piano and harmonica, Paul Griffin was on the Hammond organ, Mike Bloomfield was on guitar with Robbie Robertson, and Rick Danko was on bass. William E. Lee was also listed as a bass player in this session too. They spent a couple of hours recording it, from 2:30pm till 5:30pm. They got two promising takes, but neither ended up on Blonde on Blonde. The two takes from the session are pretty good. There's that car horn, phone ringing, sound effect laden take that is a whole heap of fun, but there's also a more bluesy cut. Whereas the finished LP track on Blonde on Blonde is blues sounding, this is more straightforward blues sounding.
Well, I see you got your brand new leopard skin pillbox head. Got your brand new leopard skin pillbox head.
While, as I say, the cuts were decent, nothing pleased Dylan enough to call the song completed. New York had once again failed. Fast forward to the end of the Nashville sessions, and Dylan and the Southern Band are cruising through takes, knocking them out the park. When they came to Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat, it didn't stand a chance. Dylan ran through the song swiftly, and Robbie Robertson made some suggestions regarding the song's eventual riff that Dylan would play. Dylan responded saying, "Oh, play the riff like this." Robertson said, "Right." McCoy then cut in and said, "How do you want to start it? Do you want to just vamp on that rhythm?" Johnston cut in from the control room and took control. He said, "Hey Bob, why don't you just start off on the guitar yourself?" "Okay," Dylan said. "Yeah, just play that lead in and we can go from there." Dylan played around with that lick that Robertson suggested and then said, "Okay, everyone play with me. Let's go." And they were off. One take. That's all it took. Done. Dylan had a little help from everyone else in the studio, but they got it over the line. In the final cut, Robertson stole the show. And then it was over. And they were on to the next song as the sessions came to that sprint finish. But as we know only too well, the sessions weren't all like this. So what about those outtakes, the songs that didn't make the cut? Well, that's something we look at next time.
In your brand new leopard skin pillbox head.
That is it for this episode. The next time I've just mentioned there will not actually be a week today, because it's Dylan's 80th birthday a week today, and I'm releasing a mini episode of the podcast, a little kind of audio treat. That's the best way I can describe it. It's a little something I've been working on for the last couple of months, and it's a short little, hopefully nice, poetic thing about Dylan at 80 and why he matters to us so much. So join me next week for that. In the meantime, take care of yourself and goodbye.
A Fueled by Coffee production.